Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, would you like to take this moment to congratulate Tom Harwood on his appointment as political correspondent at GB News?
How long have you been sitting on that as this is the opener that I'm going to use?
I thought about it the other day and I just remembered it just before we started recording, and I was very excited, and I've said it and I feel happy.
I'm really happy for you, and thanks for triggering me as we dive into today's episode. I am happy for Tom.
Nothing further to add.
I'm not getting pulled into that now, am I, Jimmy? No.
Great. I mean, we meet once every 2 weeks, fortnightly, some might say, to discuss politics, social issues, and current events. We will not be discussing Tom Harwood, which is very disappointing for me, but in this case, we are going to be talking about what exactly, Jazza?
So we have, as always, three topics. First of all, Jimmy did loads of research on Keir Starmer no longer being a viable leader of the Labour Party or something or nothing, based on his speech that he did last week that nobody has actually listened to.
I've read it in full. I'll have you know.
Jesus Christ! I mean, you
took me 10 minutes.
You're a stronger man and a faster reader than I. Give me the 411 on this, Jimmy. What did he say, and why does nobody like him anymore?
I mean, he said he tried to. It was sort of pre-briefed to journalists as being this big moment in reorienting Keir Starmer as a potential prime minister, and it's couched several times in the speech as a kind of post-war-esque moment, i.e. after the Second World War, Clement Attlee sort of proposed to massively overhaul the British state, introduce the welfare state, the NHS, and all of that
sort of
thing.
And he did, didn't he?
And he did. He was successful. Yeah. And Keir Starmer wants to kind of seize himself in that mantle. I mean, some people have drawn parallels with Johnson. Boris Johnson always talking about himself as a new Winston Churchill and that sort of thing. But basically, you know, Keir Starmer wants to say, you know, post-COVID, we need to rebuild British society in a different way, and I'm the man to do it, and the Tories are not going to do it because they don't care about you and they hate spending on the state, and they're nasty people generally. That's the TLDR of that speech.
Mm-hmm. Good side note, Clement is a name that we don't really hear very much at the moment, is it? But it's the equivalent of, like, Keir Starmer's parents thought, you know what, we're going to name this after a great socialist thinker. What's his name? Keir Hardie.
Yeah, I think he's a Labour leader. One of the first.
Yeah, exactly. And now he's the most recent. Oh, look at that. Nobody's calling their kids Clement, as far as I know.
It's not a particularly good name, is it?
I mean,
call him Clem. It's a type of fruit, isn't it? Clements.
A clementine, yeah. I met a girl called Clementine once, and all I could think of was oranges.
I've had a brainwave that Winston Churchill's wife was called... Was she called Clementine? That would be weird, wouldn't it?
Winston and Clementine.
Google it. Do some Googling in the background while you introduce the second topic, Jazza.
Winston and Clementine sounds like a posh tea that you might buy. The second...
I was right. Anyway.
Oh, well done. The second topic that we are going to be talking about is, I mean, thank God that this government are standing up for free speech on our campuses. They are going to be rolling out a new role for, I'm sure, someone who doesn't have personal links to anybody in the government. And they're going to be appointing a free speech and academic freedom champion in the Office for Students. Because apparently there's no diversity of thought in universities anymore. And Amber Rudd got her talk at a university cancelled once because people said that Windrush was bad.
So you sound as though you're unenthused by this topic, but actually you're the one that's pressed us into doing it, because there's a few surveys that I sent you that you're going to pretend that I endorsed, but I did not endorse them. I merely sent, you know, not all my tweets are endorsements.
I mean, Jimmy, read the standing orders, read them and understand them. You You said, well, I'm less worried about freedom, about cancelling events at universities now, but I'm more worried about the fact that students don't feel like that they can express their views at uni. And then you sent me two of the most, well, no, one of them is probably the worst possible, like, back of a fag packet surveys that you could have sent me that haven't even reformatted any of the statistics out of the predetermined Google Forms format that it clearly collected the data in.
I'm not sure this complaint is very relatable, but do continue.
It isn't at all. But I enjoyed looking at the evidence that you got me and concluding that your evidence was bad. And so I'm really excited to talk about freedom of speech on university campuses with you.
Yes, it's a classic, right, desirable topic.
It is. We love this shit.
Speaking of classic things, I don't know where I'm going with this. Joe Rogan, who has a better, let's be honest, podcast than we do, vastly more successful, has recently migrated over to Spotify.
Do you know how much he was paid by Spotify to migrate all of his podcast episodes over there?
Hundreds of millions or something? Hundreds of millions of dollars.
It was $100 million.
How much?
$100 million for the exclusivity deal. I'd have quite liked a bit of that Spotify, you know?
I've got to say, like, I mean, not that Rogan will care, but if I can't get a podcast on a podcatcher, I'm not listening to it. Like, I'm not listening to podcasts through Spotify.
I'm almost fully migrated onto Spotify.
I see. Like Joe Rogan.
Yeah, 100%. I followed him and his tight white muscle tees.
I just don't want it, I'm afraid. It's just it's not good. I don't know. Maybe we can talk about it a little bit more. But what we actually want to talk about is not Joe Rogan's stupendous success in the podcasting world.
Yeah, we just end up being jealous for 20 minutes.
I mean, that will happen anyway. But what we'd like to talk about is his, I want to say admission, but I don't think he really confessed this. He has stated that he is not going to have a COVID vaccine. He doesn't think he needs it.
He had a guest on who apparently is a famous boxer with a big orange mohawk called Jamar Neighbors. Right. And Jamar asked Joe Rogan whether or not he was going to have, Joe Rogan was going to have the vaccine. And he went, sorry, let me get into character. No. Like, it was the most obvious thing on the face of the planet. And he went on to say that it was because he didn't need it, because he was quite fit.
Hmm.
Which is stupid. And I don't begrudge somebody's right to be stupid. But he does have a platform with millions and millions of listeners every month. And could potentially, if he doubles down on this, could potentially be a factor in the United States, or any country, to be completely honest, not being able to achieve herd immunity through vaccination. So, fun.
There you go. With great power comes great responsibility. Luckily, we do not have power.
Figures,
and therefore have no responsibility to talk about this in a serious way.
Exactly. And I don't begrudge, like, it makes me think, oh, thank fuck, we don't have an audience anywhere near that size. Because we'd have been sued into high heaven, the shit that we've talked about.
No comment. Jezza, shall we play some music, talk about the Patreon account, and get on with the podcast?
I'd quite like that, if that's okay. Can we do that?
We can.
Nice.
If you are a fan of the Right Dishonourable podcast, you can support us by going to patreon.com/rightdishonourable. There you can subscribe to us on an episodic basis, which gives you access to exclusive segments that we do not release to anybody else. Our current patrons include Alexander Wood, Andrew Kilpatrick, David Preston, David Warner, Gemma Cumming, John O, Matt, and Michael Costa. Thank you very much for supporting the show. Also, if you don't think you're getting enough from me on this podcast, you can read my weekly newsletter on politics and other things at jdenichols.substack.com. Also, you can watch Jezza play Pokemon on his YouTube gaming channel, which for some reason can be found at youtube.com/JezzaInChina. That's probably enough advertising for one episode, so now on with the show.
Jimmy, should I have actually read Keir Starmer's speech? Why should I care? The next election is like 2024, apparently. It's just not... What he says and does doesn't really matter at the moment, does it?
Oh, that is a good question.
Thank you.
I mean, I think you personally should read his speech because you run a political podcast.
Shut up.
Which I think carries with it greater obligations than being an uninterested member of the public.
that is fair. It is a strong pillar of my online branding.
I suppose another strong pillar is not being fully informed about any of the issues that we discuss.
Yeah.
So, maybe it wasn't Brad, but I mean, a lot of these speeches are actually, it's mostly guff, basically. Just sort of saying nice things that you would expect the leader of the Labour Party to say. Although I suppose his predecessor did not always say those things. So maybe it's notable that he's just going through the motions. Mm-hmm. The speech and Keir Starmer's performance has been a pretty big political story for the last fortnight. I guess you could argue because there's not necessarily that much novel going on. There certainly are other things going on, but they're the sort of things regarding the pandemic that we've been hearing about for months on end. But yeah, I mean, as I said in the intro, he's trying to cast himself. And so, I mean, he hasn't used the word radical, but and probably advisedly so, given the connotations for Labour with that word. But he's trying to recast himself as sort of a big transformational politician, I guess, trying to compare himself to Clement Attlee and what Attlee did following World War II.
Is he trying to do that?
So one of the early lines in the speech, I believe there's a mood in the air which we don't detect often in Britain. It was there in 1945 after the sacrifice of war, and it's there again now.
Okay.
He also mentions the Beveridge report. I think Beveridge was a civil servant, and his report laid the foundations for the welfare state, which was not put together exclusively by Labour, but certainly Labour played the bigger part in putting it mm-hmm. together. Also, as mentioned before, you know, Clement Attlee was instrumental in setting up the NHS and that sort of thing. I suppose the thing is, he's trying to say, you know, this is a, you know, COVID has shown all these, has emphasised all these inequalities that already existed in society. And as we come out of lockdown, out of the, you know, pandemic, we need to reorient society in response to that. I mean, I guess you could say that these are the sort of things he would probably be saying, whether or not a pandemic had taken place. And that is undoubtedly true. One of the things that Starmer was criticised for in the wake of these speech was actually the lack of policy announcements to go along with his mm-hmm. rhetoric. I mean, one of the things that came out of it was this idea of the British Recovery Bond, which is essentially a form of government debt that would be used to, you know, build back after the pandemic, although he didn't particularly say what it would be used for as such. There's also some other stuff that he mentioned around a £20 uplift in universal credit, funding for local councils, stopping the pay freeze for key workers as well. And then there's also extending business rate relief and VAT cuts for certain industries. But all of that is kind of tinkering around the sides, really, I think. It's not particularly impressive.
Where's universal basic income? Where is broadband internet access as a human right?
I think you could say all of that. There was a distinct lack of like any policy announcements, but you know, the other thing that was kind of funny actually is that he was simultaneously trying to say, oh, you know, the Tories, you know, are not going to actually fully embrace government intervention to tackle inequality. Because, you know, in Starmer's view, the Conservatives, quote, simply don't believe that it's the role of government to tackle inequality or insecurity. Which, I mean, probably not that applicable to this government, I would say, but is certainly true about the Tories' general instincts. And I think is probably something that voters intuitively perceive in the Tories and Labour anyway. But he's also trying to, you know, say, he says, under my leadership, Labour's priority will always be financial responsibility. So he's trying to like...
Is it 2010 again?
I guess you could argue, is it also 1995 again?
Sure.
He's trying to span that gap between making Labour financially credible which was the whole Blairite project, really, while also saying, look, we're going to fund public services properly. It is very Blairite, I think. It is very reminiscent of Tony Blair. What do you make of it?
Just from what I have... to be really clear, haven't read the actual speeches, so I am informed by a lack of knowledge of the source material. But I have read and heard a lot of people talking about it and how kind of uninspired it was. Mm. And it's just a bit disappointing, isn't it? Like, you kind of want, if you're drawing the lines that he clearly was at the beginning of his speech, between 2021 and 1945, this desire for there to be kind of like this opportunity for there to be a great change in the way that we think about employment rights, benefits, work security, stuff like immigration rights and access to technology and stuff like that, all of which have been glaringly or forcefully pushed into the spotlight over the past year or so. If you're not gonna suggest something more exciting than a 20 quid uplift in benefits, then if you're not going to do it now, then when are you? Maybe towards the end of the we feel like we're towards the end of the pandemic, maybe. But other than, like, it just seems a bit uninspiring, really, doesn't it? It's a bit of a wet fart. Like, there's only so much that a big chin can do for you.
This is your consistent point of analysis.
100%.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with what you said. I mean, the only thing is, like, I guess there's this whole question of how, I think Stephen Bush in The New Statesman was writing about this, there's how these kind of announcements play among the politically engaged, and then there's how they play among the general public. Mm. And to be fair to Keir Starmer, you know, I don't think that he can win an election in the lot, like, sort of in the 18 months running up to, you know, the general election 2024, if we're assuming that's when it's going to take place. Mm-hmm. Some of the groundwork
we still don't know
built.
That though, there's this big assumption that that's when the next election is going to be. That is by no means set in stone. It could be before then. It will at least be, it has to happen before, I believe it's technically before May 2024, right?
I think so.
Rather than December 2024.
Yeah,
like, the law states it has to be the spring.
Yeah, although the Tories are repealing the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, and I'm not sure if they've repealed the requirement for it to be in May, because mm-hmm, I think mm-hmm. that was reduced as part of that act. But yeah, by 2024 at some point, mm-hmm. there has to be another general election. One thing that actually kind of came up is that it's now 10 months into Keir Starmer's leadership of Labour. And somebody said to him, like, what do you think you've kind of achieved in that time? And his answer, I don't think he completely flopped the answer, but it amounted to him saying, you know, beforehand everyone thought Labour was shit because Jeremy Corbyn was leader, and now they kind of think we're okay, or, like, you know, he's sort of
he's
steadied the ship, I guess you could say. But he's not necessarily made great inroads into actually you know, challenging the Tories in terms of, you know, winning the next general election. I mean, as Labour leader, there is still a decent chance that he'll win the next general election just by default, but you know, that's not entirely reassuring, I think, for Labour, who've now been out of power for 10 years or 11 years, I guess. So yeah, it's I think it's kind of interesting to me, like, how when it comes to assessing leaders, there is like a pack mentality among commentators, I think. If it's kind of established among political pundits that a certain candidate, such as Jeremy Corbyn during his leadership, like, is terrible, people are often quite reluctant to be the contrarian in that sort of circumstance. It's often the sense that if enough people decide that a leader doesn't have any chance, then everyone rallies around them, and vice versa as well. And I guess you could argue how much of that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in terms of how political parties perceive themselves and their own performance.
Why is he seen as the failed element here? Because he polls higher in approval polls than Labour does, He, as an individual leader, also polls higher than Boris Johnson does.
I mean, the stats I'm looking at, he's roughly equal. This is I've got some YouGov surveys about who'd be the best prime minister, and Starmer and Johnson are fairly neck and neck. Or have
I've
been
got
for
the
most of this
aggregate
year.
Of approve, disapprove.
Okay.
Kind of like over the whole of the last 2 months. Keir tends to be in the positive single digits, so between like 3 and 9%, and then Johnson is generally in the minus single digits net approval ratings. So in terms of like net approval ratings over like a couple of dozen opinion polls from this year, Starmer is ahead, not by like a huge amount, I think probably by single digits, but it's ahead. But he still outpolls the Labour Party, right?
Mm. I mean, actually, in the last like fortnight, basically, maybe a little longer, the Tories have inched ahead of Labour in terms of voting intention from the polls I've seen. Mm-hmm. Whereas actually for a lot of the time last year, they were, again, fairly neck and neck.
But also we're seeing a consolidation around incumbents generally. The US are the exception that prove the rule here, but generally there is support for those that are currently in power across the world, where opinion polls on those who are dealing with the crisis, on those in power, are pretty good in general, right?
Mm.
Regardless as to how badly you're hit by the pandemic, unless you're Donald Trump, but he did try and invade the Capitol building.
I think that's a potentially libelous allegation.
Allegedly.
I mean, I guess there's the related question of how much approval of the government essentially tracks with a more general sentiment, if you know what I mean. Like, mm-hmm. If people feel that, you know, their lives are broadly getting better, I mean, better in the context of lockdown is a fairly weird metric in some ways, but you know, what amount of like the Tories rising in approval over the last week, I mean, what amount of it is just random statistical fluctuations, and what amount is actually people can kind of see the light at the end of the tunnel regarding the lockdown and therefore are going to be feeling better about their government almost mm-hmm. irrespective of what they do? Do you know what I mean?
Well, you see similar things around kind of like markets and investment markets and stuff like that. Like the investment markets basically have decided, oh, the pandemic is over in terms of speculation. And I think a lot of people are, because of vaccines, have kind of made that assumption as well, that the they can see the light at the end of the tunnel. And I mean, that is, I think there's justification for that, but we ain't. To quote Boris Johnson, we aren't out of the woods yet.
I guess it's we're not going to like sort of go in on depth on this because it's being announced tomorrow. We're recording this on Sunday, what's the date today? 21st of February. And tomorrow the government will lay out its roadmap, much vaunted, where it will explain, probably in quite vague terms, what it's planning on reopening and in what order and mm-hmm. roughly what time frame.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the government has an absolutely crap record in terms of like predicting when it's going to open things, and it has generally been over-optimistic at more or less every turn. Are you expecting any great things from tomorrow? Is it filling you with hope that we will be able to go to the pub again, potentially, sometime?
I think I'm leaning the opposite direction, actually, in the grand scheme of things. The biggest thing that I'm worried about is them opening up too soon. Mm. And there is so much sound from the lockdown skeptics in the print media, especially, and from a load of backbench conservative MPs who are determined for us to have a set date for when we want to open up, which is also just a fucking stupid thing to be proposing. The coronavirus does not care whether it's March, April, or May. We need to decide on how to open up and when, based on data rather than anything. Were I to get anything out of any announcements that are meant to be happening across next week, I would like to understand more about what the metrics are that feed into the government's decision, whether it's hospitalizations, whether it's deaths, whether it's number of vaccines that have been administered. To be completely honest, it's probably a mix of all of them and more.
Also transmission rates, right?
Yeah, exactly. But there's kind of been this cliche of we want this to be the last lockdown.
They said that last few times as well.
Yeah, right. But I would really like this to be the last lockdown.
Yeah.
The only way that you can make sure that that is the case is by not opening up too early. That could mean that we end up needing to have a lockdown in the next couple of months again. Because I ain't up for that. I don't want to do that. I'd rather stay locked down for an extra month or two. Longer if I need to. Maybe zero COVID is a little bit beyond the pale at the moment in the UK, but as low as bloody possible for it to actually be viable for us to go to the kind of levels and maintain the kind of levels and have the kind of economic activity that we're seeing in places like Australia.
Mm.
Those are kind of my hopes, but yeah, I'm all right without the pub for the next few months if we can deal with that. Like I've found this lovely wine shop around the corner and there's a microbrewery just like 20 minutes walk away from me, so I'm okay drinking alone at home until then.
That's an interesting insight into Jazz's recreational activities.
Walking to beer.
Bringing beer from the microbrewery to my house.
And what's great is that my Fitbit classes it as a workout because I'm carrying a thing and I'm walking quite quickly. So, you know.
So maybe a good case study in how data can be misleading, I think.
Yeah, 100%. I am gaining weight.
I feel like since we've got on to the issue of sort of transmissions and that sort of thing, it would be a good time to pivot to Joe Rogan and his refusal to take the vaccine. Mm-hmm. Jazza, I'm assuming you haven't seen the full episode in which he discusses the vaccine, like his attitude to the
vaccine. I don't have time for that. The only time I watch a full Joe Rogan episode is when he's got like a pop star diva on. I watched Miley Cyrus. I watched that full thing where they talked about how she smokes a lot and that's why she's got a gravelly tone to her voice. I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, they're not the most obvious pairing. For anyone who's not watched the Joe Rogan podcast, he kind of, aside from being, you know, he is the most successful podcaster, isn't he? His podcast gets
of all
the
time,
most,
probably, yeah.
The biggest audience, which is why Spotify signed him up for so much money. And he tends to get these guests on for these very informal chats. He describes it not as an interview, but as just a conversation. And they often go on for 3, even 4 hours, I think. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Although I think with some of the celebrities he's been getting on more recently, they've kind of pared it down a bit, I assume, because the celebrities don't necessarily want to sit and chat to him for more than an hour out of their day. Mm-hmm.
I think he's a good podcaster.
I think he's an excellent podcaster.
And to be honest,
I
want that job. I want to be paid to just... I have to make do with you, Jimmy, as my kind of like... as my conversational muse. But doesn't that sound fun, just having a conversation with somebody for like 3 hours and getting paid $100 million in order to... for the pleasure of doing it? The thing is... you said it in the intro, with great power comes great responsibility... and Joe Rogan can sometimes be a fucking knucklehead, like an absolute bloody idiot. He is not alien to that fact.
He's self-aware about his own limitations as an interviewer, if you want to put it that mm-hmm. way. He often says, "I'm a moron," or I think he has literally said, "I'm a moron," and other phrases to that rough effect. And I mean, it's been widely noted that he often, I mean, he won't like take any bullshit from anyone, particularly if he feels like he knows something about a subject. But often he'll be chatting to somebody about something he's not that well versed in, and he'll just end up kind of agreeing with them, at least in soft mm-hmm. terms. And he's not the most challenging interviewer by any stretch, which I guess is why some celebrities like him. They know he's probably not going to give them that hard a time.
No Paxman.
He is no Paxman, and it does make for a very listenable podcast, but I'm sure you've had the experience of listening to segments with him chatting to somebody where you just like want to shout at him to actually, you know, challenge the person of what they're saying in various ways.
100%.
And, you know, it has, in terms of his sort of scientific discussions, I to be honest with you, I haven't listened to him a great deal throughout the coronavirus period. Not because
have you listened to him a lot before? Does he have names for his fans?
I don't think so. I don't think he's that lame, actually.
Oh, okay.
But I listened to him a lot, like previously. Yeah, like I've sort of been an on-off listener for several years.
And so that explains much.
I don't know what you mean. I tend to find he's best when he's actually chatting to comedians. I think he's really good value because he is a stand-up comic himself.
So he was having this conversation with a guy called Jamar Neighbors, who is a stand-up comedian.
Right, yeah.
When he made this, it's hardly a declaration. It was just an off-the-cuff comment, wasn't it? About the fact that he wasn't planning on getting the vaccine.
Yeah, and I think when he sort of pointed out it was off the cuff, I think a lot of the shit that gets him into trouble, and also some of his guests into trouble, I'm thinking of Elon Musk.
Who just smokes a blunt.
Who smokes some weed with Joe Rogan.
And then lost, like, a ton of money off of the stock price of
and
Tesla,
I think
although it has since recovered.
Having to change his position in one of his companies.
I think
I'm right in saying.
I think it may have been Tesla, or no?
It could have been, yeah. This is the trouble is they sort of act as though they're just in a bar having a drink with a friend, which is what makes the podcast so compelling, but is also what gets him into trouble, where he sort of says shit that, you know, somebody might say while a little bit drunk one night, and then they wake up the next day and think, oh, you know, I'm glad that that remark is not going to be reported on international news.
So Rogan said, when asked by Neighbours whether or not he was the person Neighbours, not his actual Neighbours. Whether or not he was going to take the vaccine, he said, no, I mean, I would if I felt like I needed it. I just feel like if you maintain your health, and I think for some people it's important, for some people it's good. Why do you think this evokes rage inside me, Jimmy?
So I want to actually start by saying there is a sense in which he is correct, and that is that certain people are at much less risk of dying of coronavirus or being hospitalized in an ICU of coronavirus.
Cool.
And he's like 50 or something. He's probably in reasonably good shape. I'm assuming he doesn't have underlying health conditions that would put him in an at-risk group. And in that sense, yeah, the vaccine is not for his narrow benefit, I don't think. But the problem with
Thank God there was a but.
The problem with his statement is that even if you are in a low risk category, you're not necessarily taking a vaccine for your own protection. You're taking it for the protection of other people who you might pass it on to through various ways. And as you say, like for people to be immune in a more general sense, you need to get a certain amount of people who have the antibodies, I guess, through having having had the virus or through having been vaccinated. I mean, that is that's vaccine theory in a nutshell, isn't it?
That's actually what herd immunity is, killing everyone and then
I was going to pick you off on this because you made some comment about it on a previous podcast. Like, if you let a virus stampede for a population, killing off people, you will eventually get herd immunity. Like, that is literally true.
Yes.
Right? Like,
yeah.
It's just not a good way of getting there.
So the way I understand it, and the reason that I've heard a lot of scientists be annoyed with the way that it was used, especially at the beginning of lockdown, especially in regards to the way that Sweden was dealing with things and stuff like that, was the fact that herd immunity, the way of getting to herd immunity, the only way that we talk about that in human populations is through vaccinations.
Right.
And that's
right.
Why they were using it, but they were implying that it was a well-known fact that if you let measles, as you said, stampede through a population, then you get to herd immunity. There's no case of that happening with, as far as I know, there's no case of that happening with the diseases that we vaccine for. Like, we use herd immunity. We use herd immunity as a goal because enough of the herd are immune to stop the spread of the virus.
So is what you're saying with like COVID-19, if we let it run riot, we wouldn't get to herd immunity sort of naturally, for want of a better term?
I'm not an epidemiologist, mate.
No, neither of us are.
But I don't think I would say it's probably not considered the optimal.
Well, whether or not you get to it, nobody disagrees that you'd have a lot of dead bodies on your hands.
I think, and also the problem that we have seen is the more that the virus is allowed to spread and given the opportunity to spread, the more chance it has of mutating.
Right. So that's potentially the issue, I'm guessing.
And that's the problem we have with stuff like flu, because it mutates so much that we can't get rid of flu because there is a new strand. I mean, more than once a year, but at least once a year.
And I guess flu is a type of coronavirus, so presumably
it is. Got those little spike proteins, isn't it?
Yeah, got those commonalities between the two of them. We should stop speculating too much about the science, otherwise we're going to fall into a Joe Rogan trap, I think.
100%. Do you... I thought it was quite interesting. When we were spitballing about this before we started recording, you suggested that this was a free speech issue, and it was interesting. I hadn't approached it like that. What do I think?
Shall I tell you what I think, and you can formulate your opinion
then,
in response,
and then I can just be annoyed. I can target my annoyance at you. That'd be better.
Yeah, that's generating heat and light, I think. I think when Joe Rogan or somebody else says something like this, you've had like cases of celebrities sort of stating their opinions about important matters of public policy on Twitter, and they have hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of followers. And let's say that the expert consensus, which is in some ways a fraught term in itself, but is not aligned with them, to put it mildly. Or to put it more bluntly, somebody says some, a celebrity says some ignorant shit and, people get up in arms. Mm-hmm. It's not really a problem if Joe Rogan was just a nobody, running a tiny blog or a Substack newsletter, let's say, that's only read by 15 people.
Great self read there, Jimmy.
It wouldn't really be an issue what he said. Like it might influence the small amount of people that read him, but it certainly wouldn't be a news story. And I think that I think there's a reasonable case for actually treating, random comments on, say, Reddit differently from what Joe Rogan says. Mm-hmm. But on the flip side of that,
basically has a caliber of a random comment on Reddit.
That's one of the issues that he comes up with. But on the other hand, he is still an American citizen, and he still does have the right to state his opinion. Now, some people probably think that some people, I'm sure, think that there should be actually criminal offences around spreading medical misinformation. Whether that's captured by existing legislation or new legislation.
Goes against the terms of service for a lot of websites. I don't think that saying that you're not going to take the vaccine would be classed as medical misinformation, though.
His reasoning, I think...
He doesn't need it.
His reasoning implies a degree of medical misinformation, I think. In the sense of outline that, yeah, sure, he probably doesn't need a vaccine for his own health. There's a chance that he might be one of those people that turns out to be vulnerable to COVID or gets a high viral load and comes down very badly with it, etc. But I think the odds are that he's correct, that he doesn't need it for his own health. It's the point he missed, which was omitted, is that you know, it's for the health of everyone, the population as a whole, that it, that, you know, otherwise healthy people who are at low risk of suffering from COVID badly, you know, get a vaccine. So in that sense, I think it is medical misinformation. Although you're right, he didn't out and out state it, I don't think.
Jimmy, would you, were you Spotify, would you take that episode down?
I don't really know. I'm not 100% sure.
But if you call it, if you're calling it medical misinformation, surely that is the kind of stuff that you need to take down, right?
Well, you mentioned terms of service, and I actually don't really think that we should be, in the case of, like, I would sort of have, you know, a, I'm going to use this term slightly willy, but a sort of like net neutrality for platforms like Spotify or Facebook or Reddit. I think it should be governed at a sort of national legal level rather than allowing the tech companies to work it out in their terms of service.
That's kind of the safe harbor argument, no? They like a tech company gets to be hands off and not held responsible for anything that is uploaded.
Well, I don't want them to be held responsible for anything that's uploaded, because I don't think it is the... I don't think we should be outsourcing our regulation of, you know, the public square, as it were, to private companies. I think it, you know, if we feel that it should be illegal to publish medical misinformation, maybe above a certain threshold in terms of audience, if we feel it should be illegal, then I think, you know, we should set that out. Well, I mean, the UK could set it out for itself, and there are various ways you can limit access to kind of external content in that regard. I mean, in the way that, say, Germany has much tougher rules on Holocaust denial than the UK does, and therefore the tech platforms are expected to behave differently in Germany to how they behave in the UK. So kind of stuff like I think that's a reasonable way of handling it. And I think, you know, I guess you could argue in general terms what the it whether there should be a kind of obligation not to publish wrong medical information, although that would definitely cause a lot of problems for health magazines, I think, in general, which we could talk about. I mean, ironically, actually, I read this about I read this Joe Rogan story on Men's Health. Joe Rogan is dead wrong about the COVID vaccine, and actually, Men's Health, this is potentially libelous, but I think it's They're, if you go back through Men's
Get
Health,
abs in 30 days.
There's a ton of like erroneous shit that the like health magazines publish like all the time. And if you
Men's Health isn't really a health magazine.
Yeah, really, yeah. I mean, you know, this is when we start to get into the kind of the weeds of this discussion. Really, is you know, what are we, because you know we want some leeway for people to publish incorrect information about things, because you know, I think it's just it's a ridiculous expectation to expect people to be right 100% of the time, particularly for like news organizations where a lot of stuff is about finding out what you can find out and updating it as you go, and some of that entails getting things wrong. And I don't think it would be good for society as a whole to have a blanket ban on everything like that. But I mean, maybe in the case of medical information, you'd have a different view of that. But then you have the problem of sometimes, you know, the medical industry comes to incorrect conclusions about what causes health problems. And you need an opportunity for dissenting voices to go against what the consensus opinion is, because sometimes those dissenting voices will be right, which is the general argument for, you know, having free speech in the first place, I guess, from a societal good point of view, or is one of the main arguments. So, I don't know. This is a broader point, I guess. And I've noticed you've been very quiet and restrained during this, and maybe I haven't said anything too inflammatory yet. But
no, you haven't. I broadly agree with you.
I still don't really
know what my solution is. I don't think I have one.
Okay. Well, maybe this can be something of a solution. I think, and I don't know how we get to this, but we need better norms about how, like, you know, big platform, sort of, you know, big personalities and brands and whatever conduct themselves on the internet, because
we need everybody to say that they're only as truthful as resources permit at the top of every show. Is that
well, yeah, I mean, I mean I guess you could see that as a total cop-out.
Jimmy, it is 100% what it is.
But
or like, this was intended for entertainment purposes.
Yeah, I mean, but then you but, have,
but
you
I
have
think
sort of
but
absurdities.
That completely goes against like the vibe of Joe Rogan. Like it is the idea that he sits above all of that. Like he's the modern day bro's bro. Like to the point where if you have a straight man who listens to the Joe Rogan podcast, like when you talk to if you talk to any of your straight girl mates, Jimmy, you'll know that that is a cliche of somebody to swipe left on immediately if they mention being a fan of the Joe Rogan podcast on Tinder, as an example. Like it's a particular type of like knuckleheady, douchebaggy, I know everything kind of like attitude towards the world that is very popular among especially straight men.
I thought I'd taken my Tinder profile down. I don't know how you've found it. Oh, it's in an archive somewhere.
That kind of what's the noun of humble? The humbleness, the
humility.
That kind of humility is completely counter to the, for want of a better word, branding of
Joe Rogan. I mean, you say that, but I mean, as we said before, he has described himself as a moron, and
but that is his version of I'm only as truthful as resources permit. Like people still listen to him and people still believe him, and there are going to be a load of people who are going to be like, oh, I'm also young and fit, I take his brain alpha brain supplement bullshit thing. I'm not going to get sick, and they will decide not to get vaccinated. And he has such a large audience. I mean, I ain't saying that it's possible that he's going to be a deciding factor in whether or not places can achieve herd immunity, but I think he might be a deciding factor into whether or not places can achieve herd immunity.
How big is his audience?
It's like nearly 200 million a month.
200 million?
Yeah, 200 million.
That's across the world, isn't it?
Yeah, that's across the world.
But that's still like point.
That's like one of the largest. I mean, that's not individual listeners, I don't think.
Right, but, that's downloads.
Yeah,
raw downloads.
That's still a significant number of people. Like, if all of those people are in Liechtenstein, Liechtenstein's fucked.
I mean, I think it's unlikely that all 200 million of Joe Rogan's audience is in Liechtenstein.
I don't think they'd actually fit, would they? Let's be fair.
No, but I think you're right. If you know, even say, I don't know, 0.01 of his audience takes him seriously, that's tens of thousands of people. I think, if I've done the maths correctly in my head, so that is not ideal.
I hope that he feels like he's got enough heat from this, gets on a proper clever person who can explain to him why he should get the vaccine, and he should have that conversation and put it up. Well, to be fair, that would be very much the way that he would deal with it, I think.
Some of the commentary pointed out that he has already had on experts who have explained why his logic is bad in previous episodes. So I'm not saying you're wrong that he won't repeat the exercise, but he has already done it to some degree. But I guess that how I would usually defend Joe Rogan when he gets stuck in one of these things is that I don't think that... I mean, I think it. You shouldn't assume that all of his audience take him seriously. Basically, like, and I mean, there's definitely loads of stuff I listen to of him where I think that both he and his guests are talking a load of bollocks. And I don't assume that I'm, you know, so alpha brained that I'm unique in thinking that.
Jimmy, I care about you and I love you very much, but I would never use the word alpha. And I think that's a good thing, actually.
Yeah, that's an odd sort of compliment in your own way.
No, please, no, I wouldn't. I don't want you to be alpha. I don't think you should aspire to be alpha. I don't think it is a good thing.
I think that particular train has left the station, if ever it was even there.
What, you being alpha?
If ever there was a possibility of, when alpha did you, status.
When did you even look at the timetable? Like, what is this?
This metaphor is going all over the place. So I think we need to evacuate the station as quickly as possible.
Okay, good.
Should we talk about universities, since we've already covered one issue of free speech, and now we can turn to another, which is cancel culture on campus.
Yes, Let's go for it. Do you want to give them the rundown?
I can. I can start by giving them the rundown. So I think I was saying to you before we started recording this that there was a private members bill by David Davis of former Brexit Secretary fame, I think.
Oh my God! Yeah.
Christ. Who also did
like I he's the kind of like nut job Brexiteer that I'd quite like to have around for dinner. You know, he seems quite nice.
He does kind of align in sort of libertarian civil litigation. What was it, one of his previous cases about privacy or something?
Yeah, he loves that shit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think he definitely has like a libertarian streak in him, I think it's fair to say. And he was trying to push forward this private members bill to like strengthen universities' obligations to protect free speech. I don't know if that private members bills rarely go anywhere anyway. But I assume that his concerns will be somewhat alleviated by this announcement from the government that it's going to appoint a new free speech champion, mm-hmm. which is some sort of quango position. And it's also, it says something about registration conditions for higher education. Basically, there are going to be more obligations on universities and student unions to protect controversial speech and controversial speakers. You really wanted to talk about this. So why do you think this is interesting?
Because I think it's just posturing. I don't think it actually means anything. I don't think that this role is going to have any actual bite, because in order for there to actually be a balance in the diversity of thought at higher education institutions, there is a perception, or at least the right... and a lot of people you read, Jimmy... feel like they are under attack, but frankly there are a load of absolute nut job left wingers that do not get to speak at institutions, and they're probably also going to have to be like, if this thing had any teeth, like do you have to, like, what constitutes the diversity of thought? At what point are people just nut jobs that have been given a book deal?
I think what you're asking in a roundabout way is that maybe this is a point you'd agree with, that a lot of people talk a good game about free speech. I don't think anyone wants to be seen as anti-free speech. It's kind of seen as a fundamental value. But everyone draws lines. I don't think that I would be surprised if all of the kind of free speech champions, lowercase letters there in society, all of the critics of university council culture, would genuinely defend like a
full David Icke. Like, should David Icke be able to speak at the Oxford Union?
So David Icke is a Holocaust denier and a conspiracy theorist.
He's everything. He's like all of the things that are loopy do lally. He is them. Like, he thinks that the Queen is a fucking lizard.
Yeah, I mean, and just also like in general, I guess, like, you know, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, like people with views that are just off the map in terms of acceptability. I don't, you know, and also I guess views where like the people, you know, people feel that actually there's not much point having a discussion with them, like that you can have discussions with people you disagree with and they can be enlightening and useful. And then there's some people that are just, as you say, nutty and loopy. And different people have different, you know, different views on who counts in that camp. So I don't know. So one thing that kind of came up actually while we were pitching this topic is that I think we both agree that the free speech crisis has been a bit oversold.
Jimmy, it's nice that you have evolved. That you've evolved on
my
this
position
topic.
Is evolving on this issue.
Thank you so much.
There have been a number of high profile cancellations. I think you already mentioned Amber Rudd.
Who was apparently, I didn't know this until very recently, until they covered it on the New Statesman podcast. Apparently they cancelled her talk 20 minutes before it was meant to start, and that's just a bit. That's awkward, isn't it?
That's
like, she's already
rude,
probably done
it?
Her hair and everything. Yeah, it's just a bit rude. Anyway.
But we were actually looking through, there was a King's College London study. Let me see if I can find it. It was what, of 15,000?
You've got it up. So they did a study. They analysed all of the events that they did over the years, from 2017 to 2018, I believe, is the time period of the study. And they were basically like, sure, we are committed to free speech. Like, we'd be really worried if there were any perception of free speech being curtailed in the way that we put on events and stuff like that. However, it should, and I quote, it should be stressed that these are rare events. King's College London hosts about 3,000 events a year. Over the past 5 years, there have been around half a dozen incidents which you could legitimately critique King's for not upholding its commitment to freedom of expression. That is 6 out of 15,000, which is 0.04%.
So these are just King's College events then?
Yeah, but it would not surprise me if that, I mean, a margin of error, even, that's a very, very low percentage of events that are affected by these kinds of things.
Mm.
And maybe not inviting, like, Marine Le Pen to your college to talk not be the worst thing on the face of the fucking planet.
So when I was reading some of the kind of the education trade press around this issue, one of the things they actually raised is that some of these end up being termed cancellations or no platformings or whatever actually are because, you know, relevant forms have not been filled in, which sounds like very
bureaucratic.
It's stuff to do with like...
Oh, I love it when it boils down to just something really boring.
Yeah, so, you know, I assume you have to do things like risk assessments and stuff when you're inviting speakers on. There's also this whole question around actually if there is a very controversial speaker... paying for security around the event, can be an issue.
I remember that was an issue when Nick Griffin, who was the former leader of the British National Party, spoke at the Oxford Union. The only point of reference I have for this is the fucking Oxford Union.
That's the sort of person you are.
It is. Unfortunately, listener, that's who I am.
But what happened with Griffin then?
They had a huge number of problems. This was before I went to said university. But they had a load of problems with security. They didn't have enough security, and so it was like a hazard, and it was just a load of Barney happened. I weren't there, so I don't.
Yeah.
I can't speak firsthand.
Where the cost lie in terms of like student unions are not like the richest bodies by any stretch, and if you have to actually pay a load of money to get a speaker to come to the event because of security costs and stuff, it can become prohibitive, I think. And obviously, you know, that's kind of bad. It's bad in the general sense that you know, in theory, anyone should be allowed to come and speak at university if one of the relevant societies has invited them to do a presentation or whatever. But if they literally can't afford to have appropriate security, I don't really know. I don't think you can really blame the university or the student union for that. And if the government is serious about some of these things, they should be willing to provide funding for that source of security, I think. That would be a genuine commitment to
That would free be speech. A very... Oh, my God, should we write to them? That would be nice.
I'm sure the point is...
That's a brilliant idea, actually,
Already
Jimmy.
Been made to them by members of the educational establishment.
Okay.
But whether they'll listen, I don't know.
Probably not. I don't think they plan on this person doing very much at all.
Probably not.
So broadly, I know that we're going to go into kind of like the other things that are maybe implied by freedom of speech on campuses and the way that students feel. But I worry whenever they bring up stuff like this, I really worry about the platform on which the Conservatives are going to fight future elections and how much they are going to entertain the culture war, because this very much falls into ignite the base, make big of a thing that isn't actually that big a thing, and get people animated through a cultural feeling that they have rather than talking about their prosperity or the economy or human rights or whatever you want to have your platform be. Whenever this kind of stuff comes up, and I feel it a lot whenever there is anti-trans stuff that comes up in the government, I really worry about their willingness to lean into and engage these parts of the culture war. Because I, you're like, you see them work really, really well, but they are incredibly divisive. They can have huge consequences to kind of like well-being of individuals and social groups, especially around like the trans community, and yeah, that I worry that that is going to be what they maybe hang the keeping of the Red Wall seats that they won in the last election on, kind of like more cultural stuff, the left are here to eat your babies kind of thing. I just wanted to share my anxiety with you, Jimmy.
I guess on the flip side, you know, there was last year Keir Starmer and Angela Rayner, the deputy leader of the Labour Party, both took the knee in response to the Black Lives Matter protests.
Mm.
And that's a culture war thing too, to be honest. I kind of agree with you that this particular policy is intended to stoke a certain base of the Tory party. I think, I mean, obviously, you're more sympathetic to the kind of woke agenda, I guess. So maybe, you know, you probably don't view that with the same level of hostility, but it's not unique to one side. I'm not saying that, you know, one or the other is like, I'm not saying they're equal in terms of how
I don't think they are equal. I would agree with that. But I think that is a fair point, actually. Mm. Like it's firing up the base. But one, like, I don't know. No, I'm confirmation biasing.
I also think, like, the topic around university free speech, I don't doubt that there are some views that are pretty taboo among university students. I mean, we already referenced this like pro-life survey, where you have, is it 70% of like pro-life campaigners think that they can't express their views about, you know, anti-abortion views. And you know, the thing is, like, in some ways I do kind of feel for them. I'm sure that there's like, it is quite an uncomfortable position to hold an unconventional view on a topic like that, but I don't, at the same time, you know, the phrase like people live in a society is like floating around my mind, but like, you know, in any like context,
humans breathe air,
there are like, you know, in any context, there are views that are, you know, considered taboo and that you can't say. And that's true in every kind of group. And there's things that, like, if we invited a guest on, there are things that they could say on this podcast that we would be received in a very hostile way. You've got like, people have their family where certain things can't be said, their friendship groups where certain things can't be said. Mm-hmm. It's a normal thing among different groups of people for certain things not to be said. Do you know what I mean? And I think that there is, you know, universities, yes, they are there to actually be almost uniquely tolerant of dissent and to discuss difficult ideas. And I think it's important.
And to cultivate dissent as well, not just tolerant of it, right? That's kind of like the ideal that it is meant, that they're meant to, well, they're like, it's certainly part of their rhetoric.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, student bodies are still full of, like, you know, relatively cosmopolitan young people who, you know, clearly have decided to up sticks and move to a different town to go to university, although not in the current climate.
I'd be interested if that was true. I wonder how many people actually study closer to home. I know that that's the perception, is that you move to a different town, but I know that a lot of people don't.
If you compare it to somewhere like America, in America it's very common to stay within your home state to go to university, but it's America's a lot bigger, so there is that. But I think the UK actually has a relatively, compared to some of our peers, has a relatively high amount of moving to go to university. But you know, it's attracting a certain cohort of people, and I you know, a student body at a university is not representative of society at large. And
it's also often not representative of the student body.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't even talking about the student union. I just meant, you know, students in general at a given university. Yeah. But yeah, the student union often isn't representative of the body either. So, I think these things are going to keep happening. I think it's a structural thing, really. And I think that the general climate of like intolerance towards ideas has more to do with, like, you know, things like the Brexit debate and certain amounts of polarization in society. And, you know, people are generally just more wound up about politics than they were, say, 10 years ago. So I think that's more of an issue than what's going on at universities, personally. Anything to disagree with that, Jazza?
Not really.
The listeners are going to be very disappointed.
We've been chatting for a long time. Shall we wrap up?
We probably should. Where can they find you on the internet, Jazza?
Jazza John on all social media platforms. I've been... just a little plug. I know that Jimmy has his mailing list that he likes to plug every now and
Substack,
again. If you want to engage with something that is completely unpolitical and quite childish, come along to my second YouTube channel and watch me play Pokemon. I'm going live on Fridays and Sundays and playing Pokemon.
Which Pokemon game are you playing?
Leaf Green. So it's the remake of the originals. So it's the originals, but with better graphics, basically.
Yeah, so Green actually wasn't released in the UK, was it?
But it is, it's Pokemon Blue, essentially. All the same Pokemon and stuff.
What console was that on?
I'm using an emulator control. I know. Naughty, naughty.
That's very naughty. there you go. If you want to watch Jazza play Pokemon, you now can.
Jazza John on all social media sites. What about you, Jimmy?
You can still find me, much to my disappointment, at JDE Nichols on Twitter, where I do occasionally respond to things, but largely just tweet links to stuff that I'm doing, or you can email me, jimmy@rightdishonorable.com.
His Substack is good. You should subscribe to it.
There you go.
He sometimes says stuff like Sir Major, what was his name?
Captain Tom Moore.
Captain Tom Moore. Is shit. Look at all of these sheeple thinking he's great.
That's, I mean, it's not even worth correcting that, I think. I think we'll just wrap up the podcast.
It was just like 500 words of pure hatred, listener. Absolutely terrible.
It's the sort of thing
I'd never have let him talk about it on the podcast.
It's the sort of thing that would get me deplatformed from a university event organised by the Libertarian Society.
Why do I insist on continuing to give you a platform? Anyway.
I mean, yeah, if anything, you know. The real question.
Pull the rug out. All right, shall we go?
We shall go.